Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt, that you see on the debt clock is fraud. Now, I want to make sure I don't forget to plug Jerry Wistrand. He's running for auditor in the state of Missouri. He's been on the show. I think we've had him on four times discussing the mountain he's climbing as trying to run as a Republican with a stronghold establishment Republican Party in the state of Missouri. Because, you know, when you, most people look at blue states and they look at, the Republican Party is just really bad. That doesn't mean that a red state, the Republican Party is good. What it means is that, you know, when you have a party that's in control, then that power, you know, kind of gets centralized. And that's why they say this, you know, establishment. Now, there's an establishment in all parties. But I think what we're looking at in a lot of these red states that we're fighting in, we're fighting for the Constitution, folks. And so Jerry is out there as a champion of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, I was on a call yesterday with him, and he made a comment. He said, hey, I was asked after a debate not to be pointing out how my opponent, the incumbent, you know, looks bad. And I just had to laugh. Why? Why would somebody say that? I mean, isn't that the whole point of debates in politics, to compare and contrast? And if the opponent doesn't show up because they don't want to defend themselves, then you're going to be pursued or perceived as attacking because you're pointing out, go look at his record, he's done this, he's done this, he's done this, and you speak in contrast to that. That's what a good campaign would do. And so maybe, because I don't know, I was thinking that the person that probably told him that was probably a lackey for his campaign, this the incumbent's campaign, to say, you know, you're making us look bad. Can you stop doing that? Anyway, there is a lot of hope because I believe there's a lot of people in Missouri and in these red states that love the Constitution. The problem is that they're fixated on conservatism. When we look at conservatism, and as a matter of fact, I'll just share this with you. When I see conservatism in these purple, blue, red states, what have you, this is where libertarians come in, and this is where blue-collar Democrats or, you know, Democrats with morals can come in and say, I'm conservative because I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in this. But they stand by and will continue to assume more powers and tax you more and, you know, do all sorts of things unconstitutional. Folks, there is a night and day difference between conservative and constitutional. And we have to start understanding this. I know everybody loves conservative, and conservative is what's screwing us up because it is ambiguous. Well, what does that mean? Well, I'm concerned, and this can even go down into these very dangerous waters where we start talking about our ideologies, the theology, what have you, of doctrine. And next thing you know, the question is, are we going to be on a path to a holy war? No, that's not allowed here. The idea of having a constitutional republic, that the Constitution being the supreme law of the land, there it is right there, the supreme law of the land. We should be demanding full compliance of the Constitution, not compliance to our ethics and morals. Because the guys that wrote the Constitution had better ethics and better morals than almost everybody today. And when we look at what they gave us, if we were following and keeping government within that, we would not be having all of the problems and all the overreach of, you know, telling you can't teach creation in school. Government has no business telling you what to teach in your school or even being involved in school. And that's what a constitutionalist would say. A conservative would say, well, we want to have a good moral curriculum with our school system. I say, let's wipe it out. Let's actually start from scratch. Actually, let's make sure the federal government's not involved in it. And let the counties decide how they want, you know, they want a statewide or what. Because I think overall, when we get all the people, the real stakeholders in the room, they'll start making the right decisions. But when you allow somebody thousands of miles away to make decisions for you, then, you know, just excuse the expression, you're screwed. And with that, welcome back, Sean.
Glad to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. And so, speaking of getting screwed over, how America got screwed over by the Federalist Papers, and that's why we're reading them. And we left off reading Federalist Paper 81, paragraph 12. And so what we want to do is, what I'd like to do is kind of jump into this. Now, Hamilton, as he covers all these little details, he's covering things with a very interesting nuance. And so this is why we're highlighting these very specific things. And in some cases, he's literally outright exposing what he is putting on the table that the court can do, that they have no, like, interpretation. He's already covered that. He's already covered being able to, you know, redefine and actually enforce what the laws are. So as we go through this, this is where, you know, we can actually see the real danger in how, or not even the danger, we can see the food and the breadcrumb trail of how the court was able to get into the position it got into, because it's all in the Federalist Papers, in these parts of the Federalist Papers. And to be clear here, for the record, none of it is constitutional. These are powers not delegated. So with that, let's go ahead and pick up with 13, if you would please, sir. Thank you.
Paragraph 13. I am not sure, but that it will be found highly expedient and useful to divide the United States into four or five or half a dozen districts and to institute a federal court in each district in lieu of one in every state. The judges of these courts, with the aid of the state judges, may hold circuits for the trial of causes in the several parts of the respective districts. Justice through them may be administered with ease and dispatch, and appeals may be safely circumscribed within a narrow compass. This plan appears to me at present the most eligible of that any that could be adopted, and in order to it, it is necessary that the power of constituting inferior courts should exist in the full extent in which it is to be found in the proposed Constitution.
Okay, so what he's looking at, and actually this is kind of interesting because he's laying out this idea of these district courts, these inferior courts. Obviously, this did come out of the Constitutional Convention. And obviously, when we look at Congress in the very first few years, how many members of Congress were really tending to the courts? In other words, understanding what to do and how to do it. Now, the question I have, or what I'm trying to present here, and I'm trying to actually not poison the water, but I'm trying to help everybody start looking at how instrumental Hamilton was in framing much of the framework of our federal government, from the Treasury Department as the secretary. He even created the framework for the State Department because Thomas Jefferson was not in town. He was just coming back from France. He went home first, so he was in Monticello for a few months before he showed up. And that first year, he had to show up in New York. So it's not like, you know, he walked in day one and said, okay, well, you know, rubbed his hands. Where do we start? Let's dig in. Hamilton took very, you know, did Jefferson a huge favor and took detailed care of setting up the State Department before he set up the Treasury. because he knew if Jefferson showed up, you know, at any moment while he's trying to configure the State Department, then, you know, Jefferson, hey, hands off. I'm doing this. This is my department. You take care of your own. So the sooner he got done with that and get everything in motion, it was, well, we thought that this is what you do anyway. And Jefferson was not happy. But nevertheless, if we knew he did that, what else was he doing? And because the Supreme Court hadn't been fielded yet, and the Supreme Court didn't have the authority to set up inferior courts. Who did? In the Constitution, it's Congress that is to establish the inferior courts as needed. Well, who was working with Congress at that time? And as a matter of fact, trying to help, you know, this nation get kickstarted, that was Hamilton driving the Assumption Act. Hamilton was the guy, but he was the man behind the curtain in so many ways that he doesn't get the credit for all of the damage that he did, if that makes sense.
It does.
So you can start seeing, because we talked briefly about the Whiskey Rebellion and how there's no doubt in my mind he helped Congress concoct this idea of running this through the judiciary, for the president to run it through the judiciary, opening that door to the judiciary over something that they shouldn't even be involved in. And he's already kind of made this point that it's like they're going to be the super overseers. Now, we've read other documents from Madison that state otherwise, that the overseers of the federal government is not within the federal government. It is the state legislatures. They're the ones that are supposed to be making sure that framework is being done properly to serve them, not to subjugate them. And they didn't see it coming. So, as we look here, he's talking about creating these inferior courts. Now, that's something that Congress had to do. And fortunately, Hamilton was there and in a position to work with Congress to be able to help them create these inferior courts. So are you surprised that they created these districts like they did? Boom, right here. He was talking about this. Well, this is what I would think. Because he says here, I'm not sure, but that it will be found highly expedient and useful to divide the United States into these districts. So let's go ahead and dive into 14, because in here, he's basically going to help segregate what and how important these districts technically aren't, but he's creating this importance. And we'll dive into this with 14. Let's go ahead and go into 14. Thanks.
These reasons seem sufficient to satisfy a candid mind that the want of such a power would have been a great defect in the plan. Let us now examine in what manner the judicial authority is to be distributed between the Supreme and the inferior courts of the Union. The Supreme Court is to be invested with original jurisdiction only, quote, in cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, end quote. Public ministers of every class are the immediate representatives of their sovereigns. All questions in which they are concerned are so directly connected with the public peace that, as well for the preservation of this, as out of respect to the sovereignty they represent, it is both expedient and proper that such questions should be submitted in the first instance to the highest judicatory of the nation. Though consuls have not in strictness a diplomatic character, yet as they are the public agents of the nations to which they belong, the same observation is in a great measure applicable to them. In cases in which a state might happen to be a party, it would ill suit its dignity to be turned over to an inferior tribunal. Though it may rather be a digression from the immediate subject of this paper, I shall take occasion to mention here a supposition which has excited some alarm upon very mistaken grounds. It has been suggested that an assignment of the public securities of one state to the citizens of another would enable them to prosecute that state in the federal courts for the amount of those securities, a suggestion which the following considerations proved to be without foundation.
That's his way of dismissing something that may actually have merit, where there's probably a lot more behind that, and probably something that he perceives as a real threat that, you know, doesn't have any foundation, as he, without foundation. Or you'll call it a phantom or a red herring. But up at the very top, he says, let us now examine in what manner the judicial authority is to be distributed between the Supreme and the inferior courts of the United States. That the Supreme Court to be vested with original jurisdiction only in cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and councils and those in which a state shall be a party. Today, how many times do we see states actually go straight into the Supreme Court over something that does not arise under the Constitution? And I'll give you a case in point. The state of Washington has sued the Trump administration over environmental laws and over environmental problems. The scaling down, the funding of the supporting the regulations. Let's be clear here, folks. There is nothing arising under the Constitution that has anything to do with the environment. You follow me? So when a state comes along and says, we want to come in and, you know, talk, because it was the states that actually got this. How did the Supreme Court ultimately make the decision over what CO2 is and what's acceptable? That came in from the courts. I mean, from the states. There's this direct relationship, because when he says he's isolating that the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction in this capacity, but he misses the very first part. And it says this in the Constitution. Let me get over to it. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. So in other words, if it's something, if it's a law, if it's a lack of law, lack of funding a law, that it does not arise under the Constitution, then why is the Supreme Court wasting our tax money in hearing these things? There you go. If
I have no idea.
No. So I'm going to tell you, because they are all on board with aggrandizing more and more control and power over the states and the people. In other words, this idea of a Republican form of government, this idea of a limited and defined government is gone. You can't have that anymore as far as they're concerned. They can do anything they want, and they're basically begging us to stop them. And folks, we have the ability to do this. And this is why counties matter most, is why you have to start in your county and take your county courts back. There's no reason why you don't have common law courts. There's every reason why the state has no jurisdiction and shouldn't be involved in your common law courts and cases. But anyway, so here's Hamilton using this little sleight of hand by saying that they have original jurisdiction, but he mentions nothing to the parameters of that jurisdiction, of everything being anything that has in dealing with the states. Unless it's arising under that, like a conflict in commerce, where one state is not allowing another state to sell their goods or transport goods through it to, you know, get to the port in their state to ship it abroad. These things are happening all the time. Wyoming has been suffering for years, for well over a decade, because the West Coast has denied them the shipping of their coal out their ports to go to China and everywhere else. That is a direct violation of the Constitution. And why is this not going into the Supreme Court and saying, hey, where does Washington get the power to deny us this? It's one thing that they give us a fee, a reasonable fee, but they're hiding under these things called environmental laws that they've created. And that doesn't arise under the Constitution, nor does it arise under the state constitution. It arises under the Environmental Protection Agency and under international laws, but nothing to do with our state and federal constitutions, period. So my point is, folks, is that the fact that we have zero sight here on what the real jurisdiction of the federal court is for any and all cases, they have to arise under the Constitution for you, for me, for the states. Now, for consuls and ambassadors and admiralty and those types of things, we covered this before. Those are unique, separate things that only the Supreme Court would have jurisdiction, because it has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with how we interface with the rest of the world. And that's it. Anything that has to do with us, it has, for us to walk into that federal court, for them to justify dragging you into a federal court, they have to prove jurisdiction. They have to prove that this issue that they're dragging you in on arises under that Constitution. This is why they have a living Constitution that they edit on a daily basis. And it gets updated and updated. When they run into a little brick wall, they just burn that and bury that little wall so that nobody hears about it. And then they go in and fix the annotated Constitution and say, now that brick wall can't exist because we've made the fix so that we can pull it in and we have jurisdiction over it now. It's, that little story you hear, when you're hearing kids playing, or not the story, you hear this little charge. Some kid that's playing with these other kids. You're making it up as you go along, because that's exactly how they're doing it, folks. They're making it up as they go along. All right, so let's go into 15. And we got about 2 minutes left, so let's realistically look at this. Do you have any comments over what we talked about, or what? What do you want to do?
We can go ahead and try to get some of this.
Okay, just go ahead and nail it, and I will kind of give a beep, and we can stop at that point. Go ahead.
15, it is inherent in the nature of sovereignty not to be amenable to the suit of an individual without its consent. This is the general sense and the general practice of mankind, and the exemption, as one of the attributes of sovereignty, is now enjoyed by the government of every state in the Union. Unless, therefore, there is a surrender of this immunity in the plan of the convention, it will remain with the states, and the danger intimated must be merely ideal. The circumstances which are necessary to produce an alienation of state sovereignty were discussed in considering the article of taxation and need not be repeated here. A recurrence to the principles there established will satisfy us that there is no color to pretend that the state governments would, by the adoption of that plan, be divested of the privilege of paying their own debts in their own way, free from every constraint, but that which flows from the obligation of good faith. The contracts between a nation and individuals are only binding on the conscience of the sovereign and have no pretension to a compulsive force. They confer no right of action independent of the sovereign will. To what purpose would it be to authorize suits against states for the debts they owe? How could recovery be enforced? It is evident it could not be done without waging war against the contracting state. And to ascribe to the federal courts, by mere implication and in destruction of a pre-existing right of the state governments, a power which would involve such a consequence, would be altogether forced and unwarrantable.
Okay, so we made it through. Great. And it's interesting because he's making some points here that actually argue against him for the Assumption Act. I mean, it's one thing that the states already created this and they owe this money. And what he ended up doing with the Assumption Act is an absolute, it's a 180, and it's in direct conflict with the Constitution and what he's talking about here. They have to have the ability to compel them into getting that money. So anyway, we can talk a little bit more about this. And, he's creating an argument that actually, like I said, flies in the face of what he argued with the Congress. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
And so he, because it's interesting, he's talking about state and state debt. And right in the middle here, it says, there is no color to pretend that the state governments would, by the adoption of that plan, he's talking about the Constitution, be divested of the privilege of paying their own debts in their own way. So how is it that Congress could come along and then pass a law and say, we're going to forgive your debt and we're going to assume that debt for you? Does that make sense? Because that's what he did when he was the treasurer. He came in directly with the plan of assuming the debt. But what he's saying is, how can they be divested of the privilege of paying their own debts in their own way, from free from every constraint but that which flows from the obligations of good faith? Does that make sense? Do you see the conflict of what he's saying here, and then what he says is that it's our obligation to basically assume their debt?
Or bring out the army.
Or bring out the army. Well, okay, so that's about enforcement, though. And they're obligated to pay their debt. And so they're not being divested of the dignity of being able to pay their debt. But bottom line, he's creating this, what I see is everybody's agreeing, yeah, the states need to pay their, they need to pay their share. They need to pay it, not be forgiven it, and then be brought into this concocted plan of buying, you know, bonds and shares and so forth by trying to pump money into this bogus bank, this bogus commercial bank that they were creating. Okay, so let's dive into 16. Go ahead.
Paragraph 16. Let us resume the train of our observations. We have seen that the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court would be confined to two classes of causes, and those of a nature rarely to occur. In all other cases of federal cognizance, the original jurisdiction would appertain to the inferior tribunals, and the Supreme Court would have nothing more than an appellate jurisdiction, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, end quote.
I'm trying to understand how the inferior courts would have the original jurisdiction. It would be such a rare case, because 9 times out of 10, most cases that are being brought into courts are cases between one state and another. And, in other words, the states would try to go down the path of settling, because the each state has their own court system. And they have the ability to, solve these problems directly. Why would they not do that? And why would they go, unless it is got to a point where, to me, that would be the appeal. The appeal, we can't solve this problem, we need the federal government, like a Commerce Clause problem. But other things, I would think that most all cases are going to be kept within each of the states. Madison made this point, and we'll get to it when we hit Virginia ratification base, which is a ways down the road. But Madison points out that when you really look at all of the cases that are in the states today, over 90% of them will remain in the state's cases, in the state courts, because there's very little things that arise under the Constitution that would drive something into the federal courts. It was John Jay, that realized that there was really nothing to do. So when he stepped out of, you know, being the Chief Justice so he could go work on the Mississippi Treaty, wow, he just loved it. Now he had something to sink his hands into and just, you know, chew on. And he came back with a big, absolute, you know, failure, big zero. Didn't work. His treaty didn't work. Well, when he was asked to go back into the court, he basically told Washington, no, that's a passive court system, and it's you know, there's really nothing for us to do other than just make rulings on cases. That was all they could do. Jay understood the limited power of the court. He did not see a future, and he was one of the framers. He was in the debates on the ratification. He was also involved in the Federalist Papers, the writing of the Federalist Papers. He wasn't in the debates in Congress, but John Jay had been around. I mean, he was a pretty renowned framer for his time. So if he saw that, then what the heck happened? How did all of a sudden the Supreme Court become something that John Jay didn't see? Understanding what it could be, you know, what was documented and so forth. So let's go ahead and dive into 17.
17. The propriety of this appellate jurisdiction has been scarcely called in question in regard to matters of law, but the clamors have been loud against it as applied to matters of fact. Some well-intentioned men in this state, deriving their notions from language and forms which obtain in our courts, have been induced to consider it as an implied supersedure of the trial by jury in favor of the civil law mode of trial, which prevails in our courts of admiralty, probate, and chancery. A technical sense has been affixed to the term appellate, which in our law parlance is commonly used in reference to appeals in the course of the civil law. But if I am not misinformed, the same meaning would not be given to it in any part of New England. There, an appeal from one jury to another is familiar both in language and practice, is even a matter of course, until there have been two verdicts on one side. The word appellate, therefore, would not be understood in the same sense in New England as in New York, which showed the impropriety of a technical interpretation derived from the jurisprudence of any particular state. The expression, taken in the abstract, denotes nothing more than the power of one tribunal to review the proceedings of another, either as to the law or fact or both. The mode of doing it may depend on ancient custom or legislative provision. In a new government, it must depend on the latter, and may be with or without the aid of a jury, as may be judged as advisable. If, therefore, the reexamination of a fact once determined by a jury should in any case be admitted under the proposed Constitution, it may be so regulated as to be done by a second jury, either by remanding the cause to the court below for a second trial of the fact, or by directing an issue immediately out of the Supreme Court.
So he is also saying here in the middle that there's obviously these differences of how the state's judicial systems are configured. Today, the only difference in judicial systems that I know of are between Louisiana, their process, and all other 49 states. Is that about right?
Yes, sir. We're special.
Well, I know, and I'm just saying that Louisiana has been able to take that position as a civil law state. All the common law states were manhandled by the federal government to basically start, implementing standard trials by jury. It's now they're just jury trials. A trial by jury, I don't think happens anymore. And the big difference between a trial by jury and a jury trial is a trial by jury, the jury has full and final say. A jury trial is a trial where the judge can't step in and nullify a jury ruling and basically make, you know, a verdict themselves, which is kind of scary because most people think a jury trial, you're safe with, you know, with the jury. And so as we start peeling this whole process from when the Constitution was ratified to today, we have been manhandled inch by inch, you know, fist by fist, into conforming to the Bar Association and the justice system that they had framed for us, instead of allowing self-determination and evolution in each of the states to continue. That's what it was supposed to be. Now, we'll get into that when we get into the further ratification base, but let's move forward with 18. Go ahead.
Number 18, but it does not follow that the reexamination of a fact once ascertained by a jury will be permitted in the Supreme Court. Why may it not be said with the strictest propriety, when a writ of error is brought from an inferior to a superior court of law in this state, that the latter has jurisdiction of the fact as well as the law? It is true it cannot institute a new inquiry concerning the fact, but it takes cognizance of it as it appears upon the record and pronounces the law arising upon it. This is jurisdiction of both fact and law, nor is it even possible to separate them. Though the common law courts of this state ascertain disputed facts by a jury, yet they unquestionably have jurisdiction of both fact and law. And accordingly, when the former is in the pleadings, they have no recourse to a jury, but proceed at once to judgment. I contend, therefore, on this ground, that the expressions, quote, appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, end quote, do not necessarily imply re-examination in the Supreme Court of facts decided by juries in the inferior courts.
Yeah, so I think he's starting to, in this, I think this right here gets to what comes out of a court. What is the ultimate output of a court? As the Constitution laid this out, and this was really well sold, that the federal court system would give you a verdict, and the final verdict would come from the Supreme Court if it is a appropriate jurisdiction type of verdict. Even though today everybody just abides by the Supreme Court, what it says, whether it had jurisdiction or not. So that's a huge problem right there. But as the courts start making verdicts, along with those things came opinions. And opinions started extrapolating ideas, principles, and or laws. And what ended up happening is, this is when the court basically says, you know, that was a really good opinion by such and such justice. And what they did was they kind of created this principle. And we're going to carry that forward by using case law precedents. And by using multiple cases, it usually takes two, where they support a principle. Now, in Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, and those two, in both of those cases, the concept of one person, one vote was a principle that came out of those rulings, which meant that then the Supreme Court dictated that as a law that the states needed to enforce, that every person gets a vote, and their vote is to be equal. One person, one vote. And so that all had everything that you legally, of course that makes sense. You know, one person, one vote. Nah, the connotation behind that is, if you live in a county that has 500 people, you have a representative in the state house that represents you in the house, and you have a senator that represents you in the Senate. Now, this county over here has, you know, 2 million people, and they have, you know, probably 10 representatives to represent the people, and they have one senator to represent the county. Because your threshold, you know, being 500 or whatever, is a very small amount, you've got the base minimum of one representative, which means that your representative creates a greater inequality between what you want and what these other people want that are divided 2 million by 10. Am I making sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So this is where the Supreme Court basically said, now representation within state houses will be done by population so that everybody will have equal representation within that state house. Well, that's fine if you're a democracy. But we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. And each of the counties are significant bodies of government. They were governments formed by the people. The only problem, folks, is that they weren't properly formed by the people. Even though, as you know, you got out the gate and started the state up, and every county in the beginning was established by the federal government to kind of serve the people, because the people were too busy trying to make homes and grow crops and you know, get their cattle into, you know, the stocks or what have you for sale. Everybody was just busy with life. So the federal government kind of came in and they did lots of things for us. One of those things was they established your county, they gave you a judge, and they appointed a marshal, and then you got to vote for your sheriff. Now, most people think that that was your representative, but no, that was not a representative. As a matter of fact, that was not a government to be either. That was actually a beginning of a government by having the boundaries of a county, by creating a judge. But more importantly, in a Republican form of government, you need to have representatives. So one of the things that all the counties were doing, they had a board of supervisors or commissioners. And these people that were serving on this board, they weren't really elected. They were just kind of the spokesperson for the community. Whoever everybody liked, and they became elected or what have you. But there was no pay to this. And this was at a time when government wasn't doing anything to really affect your everyday life. They weren't involved in your life. The only reason that they had these councils or these supervisor committees or, you know, commissioner boards, the only reason they had them is because they were dealing with the state legislature to make sure what the state legislature was doing wasn't going to have an adverse effect, or making sure that, you know, you got things done that you needed in, you know, creating better lanes of commerce with other counties in the state, whatever. But again, the government's involvement was so minuscule. Today, it's in every aspect of your life. And the reason your counties are being railroaded, the reason your counties are being marginalized by the court, is because we the people failed to do that axiom that Thomas Jefferson basically established for us as a nation. That governments are instituted by men, or we the people. It's not to be governed. His point in saying that was, governments are instituted by we the people, not the king. That we have a say in our government. And you go read that very first clause or that very first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, you'll see that governing comes from the consent of the governed. That we have this inherent right to, you know, establish our government, and if we're not happy with it, we have an inherent right to alter it or abolish it and create a new one. And this is the beautiful point. You've never taken full control, but you can. Even though you haven't done it, and even though everybody's marginalized it, all you need to do is put your foot down and go, you know what, we're actually going to legitimately create our county. And in so doing, the legitimate creation comes from that constitution where you delegate them powers. We can talk more and more about this, but the whole point that I went down this rat hole, started swimming, and I think I lost my point, other than the fact that when we're looking at, you know, these jurisdictions, law, fact, and so forth, and how juries and, you know, judges can make, you know, these rulings and so forth. When you actually create your county constitution, now you can dictate common law to be the law of that county as a part of the territory and state, because you can go back to, you know, the founding. Because I can tell you, in 1851, the state of Washington was established with common law as law of the territory of that soon-to-be state. That's the law of the land. And as a matter of fact, the common law of England. Now, there's all sorts of problems I have with these things. But the bottom line is they unwittingly did things that actually is going to make our life so much easier. Because common law is supposed to be our justice system, you can now shut down the civil law processes and just start streamlining things into justice. But in this particular case, when we allow the courts to control us and assume more power, it's almost at a point where almost everything is hinging upon the Supreme Court of the United States to make a final verdict on this, that, and the other thing. And it was never designed to be that way. Never designed to be that way. The only part of the federal justice system was to ensure the justice of a controversy, not to control the justice system and not to shape it and basically edict, you know, what justice we will get and whether we'll be happy with it or not. It's our own problem. Anyway, this final pot, you know, the appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, close quote, as he says, does not necessarily imply a re-examining of the Supreme in the Supreme Court of facts decided by juries in the inferior courts. As a matter of fact, the understanding was at that time and still is today, any trial that is done by a jury cannot be re-examined other than administratively. Was the rights of the person in the process or what have you been denied? In other words, they can't look at the verdict in law and fact or anything. The only thing they can really look at was this person fairly tried? And were they using, you know, was there evidence that was found that was suppressed that should have been brought forward? That type of stuff. That's all they're supposed to be looking for. And that's typically, in those kind of cases where there's a jury, that's usually a criminal trial. That's at least what you were told today. But in a property, in common law, and when we read the Seventh Amendment, I'll say it again, that in cases of common law where the controversy is greater than $20, the trial by jury shall be preserved. The right to a trial by jury shall be. So in common law cases, if the case is, you know, a controversy of over $20, like divorces need to be in front of a jury, folks. Whether we like it or not, you know, many of our cases where we're like your speeding tickets, it's over $20, right? They're taking $20 because you were speeding. Maybe you had a good reason, because the whole point of the trial by jury wasn't that, you know, it was a black and white law system. If you could make an appeal to the jury, they could nullify the consequences. That's, you ever heard of jury nullification, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And it's one of those things that scares lawyers because, wow, look at, you know, we can create laws and they won't abide by them because this is going to fall under a jury every time. What are we going to do? Well, we got to convince them that they can't do that anymore, that we control this and we're going to put them in front of a judge and we will lay the law down upon them with swift prejudice and justice. Anyway,
just us.
Let's do 19.
Number 19. The following train of ideas may well be imagined to have influenced the convention in relation to this particular provision. The appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court parenthetics, it may have been argued in parenthetics, will extend to cause determinable in, wait, let me do that again, will extend to causes determinable in different modes, some in the course of the common law, others in the course of the civil law. In the former, the revision of the law only will be, generally speaking, the proper province of the Supreme Court. In the latter, the reexamination of the fact is agreeable to usage, and in some cases, of which prize causes are an example, might be essential to the preservation of the public peace. It is therefore necessary that the appellate jurisdiction should, in certain cases, extend in the broadest sense to matters of fact. It will not answer to make an express exception of cases which shall have been originally tried by a jury, because in the courts of some of the states, all causes are tried in this mode, and such an exception would preclude the revision of matters of fact, as well where it might be proper as where it might be improper. To avoid all inconveniences, it will be safest to declare generally that the Supreme Court shall possess appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, and that this jurisdiction shall be subject to such exceptions and regulation as the national legislature may prescribe. This will enable the government to modify it in such a manner as will best answer the ends of public justice and security.
Okay, so up at the top, I'm going to only make this point because this gets brushed over. He says common law and others in the course of the civil law. What is the civil law? Now, we're not talking about the civil law system and common law system. We're talking about actual laws that arise under these two different modes in society. So civil law is the law that we create. And in America, the only laws that can be applicable to us from government is what laws? Laws that are in pursuant to the constitutions. In other words, can the state make a law that is, you know, confining you to something that is not delegated to them in the Constitution? Absolutely not. That's an unconstitutional law. Civil laws are laws that they have the authority to make that step outside the common law. This is not, so when he's talking, you know, in the common law and in civil law, he's not talking about the big grand jurisdiction framework, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so when we hear people talk about civil law, as a matter of fact, there's these organizations like the ACLA or ACLJ or whatever they are, ACLU, where they talk about, you were violating my civil rights. This is a civil law matter. That's kind of what they're referring to, not necessarily the civil law system. So we've kind of ran out of time, but hopefully that makes sense of differentiating what he was saying up there, that there is such a thing as civil law, but only legitimate civil law. In other words, it must be in pursuance to the Constitution, because any law that has been made arbitrarily without the authority governed or the authority delegated to the legislature to create that law, then you're dealing with arbitrary law or tyranny instead of actual legitimate civil law. Again, must be in pursuance to the Constitution, because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. With all of that, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.